The sun stood still high above the western horizon, and far up in the sky two vultures described long-drawn spirals in the air, and in their cries I seemed to recognize the voice of the Queen of the Nymphs. On the opposite side of the valley was still the rushing waterfall with the foaming basin, and the spray still rose in the air, and the water still sped over the moss-covered edge. "Alas!" I exclaimed, "has all I have seen been nothing else than a dream? Has that which seemed so beautiful and real been merely an illusion of my brain, and have I now returned to real life? Why did I not die in the arms of the Queen, and thus save myself this horrid awakening?" I rose, and, as I rose, my eye fell upon the bud of a white lily sticking in a buttonhole of my coat. I could not believe my eyes, and suspected that I was again the victim of a hallucination. I grasped the lily. It did not vanish in my grasp, it was as real as the earth upon which I stood. It was of a kind which does not grow in these cold mountainous regions, it only grows where the air is mild and warm. I remembered the gold, I put my hand into my pocket, and there, among the few remaining silver pieces, I found a solid lump of gold as bright as the purest, but the little ruby pearls had dropped off from its surface and were lost. I then recollected the precious book which the adept had promised to send to my room in the village inn, but somehow it seemed to me that I had committed an indiscretion during the absence of Theodorus by prying into the secrets of his laboratory and listening to the temptations of the nymphs. I felt as if I did not deserve the favor, and was doubtful whether or not he would send me the book. I flew rather than walked down the mountain, along the road leading toward the village. Little did I now care for the scenery, neither for the mountain tops, which were gilded by the rays of the setting sun, nor for the murmuring river. It grew dark, and the full moon arose over the hills, looking exactly like the moon I had seen some hours before in the Indian Ocean. I calculated about the difference of time between Germany and Ceylon, and I found that indeed I might have seen the moon shine in the Bay of Bengal while the sun was shining in the Alps. I arrived at Ho. Little heeding the astonished looks of the villagers, who may have believed me insane as I hurried through the streets. I entered the inn, rushed upstairs to my room, and, as I entered, I saw upon the table the precious book, the secret symbols of the Rosicrucians of the 16th and 17th centuries. On the fly leaf were written a few lines in pencil, saying, "Friend, I regret that you left our home so abruptly, and I cannot invite you to visit us again for the present. He who desires to remain in the peaceful valley must know how to resist all sensual attractions, even those of the Water Queen. Study this book practically, bring the circle into a square. Mortify the metals, calcinate and purify them of all residua. When you have succeeded, we shall meet again. I shall be with you when you need me. Yours fraternally, Theodorus." It may be imagined that, in spite of my fatigue, I did not go to sleep very early. I walked up and down in my room, thinking over the events of that memorable day. I tried to find the line between the visible and the invisible, between the objective and subjective, between dreams and reality, and I found that there was no line, but that all these terms are merely relative, referring not merely to the conditions of things which appear objective or subjective to ourselves, but to our own conditions, and that while in one state of existence certain things may appear real to us and others elusive, in another state the illusions become real, and that which before seemed to be real is now merely a dream. Perhaps our whole terrestrial life will seem to be at the end nothing else than a hallucination. As I walked about the room I observed a Bible belonging to my host lying upon a cupboard. I felt an impulse to open it at random and to see what it said. I did so, and my eye fell upon the 12th chapter of the second epistle of the Apostle Paul, written to the Corinthians, where it said, "I knew a man in Christ, above 14 years ago, whether in the body or whether out of the body I cannot tell, God knoweth, such a one was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter." Sa'duddin Muhammad Shah Bastari, forgotten Islamic Sufi mystic. There remains one great expert on the life of Shah Bastari, forgotten Islamic Sufi, mystic, Florence Lederer. Allow Florence to introduce you to the life of Shah Bastari and the doctrines in which he lives, believed and experienced God. Life of Shahbastari, by Florence Lederer. It is inward glow that makes the Sufi, not the religious habit. Sa'duddin Mahmud was born at Shahbastar, near Tabriz, about AD 1250. He wrote the Gulshan-i-Raz, or Secret Rose Garden, as a reply to questions put forth by a Sufi doctor of Herat named Mursid Hosseini. Very little is known of Mahmud Shahbastari's life. He wrote beside the Gulshan-i-Raz two treatises on Sufism called Haqq-ul-Yaqin and Risala-i-Shaded. We learn he had a very favorite disciple called Sheikh Ibrahim. The Gulshan-i-Raz was introduced into Europe by two travelers in 1700. Later, copies of the poem were found in several European libraries. In 1821 Dr. Thilluk, of Berlin, published extracts, and in 1825 a German translation of part of the poem appeared in another of his books. Afterwards a verse translation and the Persian text was published by von Hammerpurgstall in Berlin and Vienna. The Gulshan-i-Raz was translated into English and published, with the Persian text and extracts from Hammer's edition and Lajahi's notes, by Mr. Winfield in 1880. Sufi poetry. Readers of Sufi poetry for the first time are liable to be amazed, perhaps even repelled, by the extravagant language, by the familiarity with a deity, by the apparent disregard of all human and divine laws. But on further examination the wonder of the Sufis' love for their beloved shines out with a clear intensity, a beautiful luminous brightness. They are in love with the One, and their love takes the form of exquisite songs of praise and wonder. I heard entranced. My spirit rushed to meet love's welcome order, for the voice was sweet. Vaughan says, Oriental mysticism has become famous by its poets, and into poetry it has thrown all its force and fire. The Sufis have one sole and simple task, to make their hearts a stainless mirror for their God. Love is the Sufis' theme, divine, eternal love, and into this sea of love they cast themselves headlong. Rumi sings, moths, burnt by the torch of the beloved's face, are the lovers who linger in the sanctuary. If we are called madmen or drunkards, 'tis because of the cupbearer and the cup. Because my mouth has eaten of his sweetmeats in a clear vision I can see him face to face. End of that part of the book. Then jumping many pages further, we come to the headline, the inter-relation of the spheres. Moreover, friend, it is a good thing and a helpful to bear in mind our presence at all times, for we are near, and that in ways both many and various. When we are personally near at hand we are able to impress you with helpful thoughts and intuitions, and so to order events that your work may be facilitated and your way more clear than otherwise it would appear to you. Purified by suffering. Light and darkness are states of the spirit, as you know. When those dwelling in the darkness cry for light, that means that they are become out of touch with their environment. So we send them what help is needed, and that is usually direction by which they find their way, not into regions of light, where they would be in torture, and utterly blinded, but, into a region less dark, and tinctured by just so much of light as they may bear until they outgrow that state and cry in their longing for more. When a spirit leaves a dark region for one less dark he experiences an immediate sense of relief and comfort by comparison with his former state. For now his environment is in harmony with his own inner state of development. But as he continues to develop in aspiration after good, he gradually becomes out of harmony with his surroundings, and then, in ratio to his progress, so his discomfort increases until it becomes not less than agony. Then in his helplessness, and approaching near to despair, having come to that pass when his own endeavors can go no further, he cries for help to those who are able to give it in God's name, and they enable him one stage onward nearer to the region where dimness, rather than darkness, reigns. And so he at last comes to the place where light is seen to be light, and his onward way is henceforth not through pain and anguish, but from joy to greater joy, and hence to glory and glory greater still. But oh, the long, long ages some do take until they come into that light, ages of anguish and bitterness, and know all the time that they may not come to their friends who wait them until their own unfitness is done away, and that those great regions of darkness and lovelessness must first be trod. But do not mistake my words of their meaning. This is no vengeance of an angry God, my warden friend. God is our Father, and He is love. All this sorrow is of necessity, and is ordered by those laws which govern the sowing, and the reaping of that which is sown. Even here, in my own place, where many things both wonderful and lovely we have learned, yet not yet have we attained to plumb and sound this mystery to its lowest depth. We do understand, as we were unable when in the earth life, that it is of love that these things are ordained. I say we are able to understand where formerly we were able but to say we trusted and believed. Yet little more of this awful mystery do we know, and are content to wait until it is made more plain to us. For we know enough to be able to believe that all is wise and good, as those in those dark hells will know one day. And this is our comfort, that they will and must be drawn onward and upward into this great and beautiful universe of light, and that then they will confess, not only that what is just, but that it is of love and wisdom too, and be content. Such have I known, and do know, and am of their number in the service of the Father. And it seems to me their praise and blessing of Him are nowise lacking in love in comparison of ours who have not journeyed through those awful depths. Excerpts from the Highlands of Heaven, Volume 2 to the Life Beyond the Veil, Series, by Reverend G. Veloin, The Greater World Association, UK, 1922. Next is, Swami Abhedananda. Forgotten Hindu mystic Swami Abhedananda, wrote a series of profound works but is most known for his auspicious association with Sri Ramakrishna, a well-known and highly respected Hindu saint in the late 1900s. One of his original 15 disciples, Swami Abhedananda had the distinction of spending much of his life in the presence of this his name meant that which has no differentiation, and it was given to him shortly after Ramakrishna's death. His original name at birth was Kali Prasad Chandra. In his youth, Swami Abhedananda was known for his scholarly pursuits, learning Sanskrit and studying Western philosophy. When he first came into contact with Sri Ramakrishna, the saint immediately knew him and said, "You were a great yogi in your previous birth. This is your last birth. I am going to initiate you in the practice of yoga." This according to the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture. During Sri Ramakrishna's final illness, Swami Abhedananda was one of those disciples who stayed closest to his side and nursed him in his final hours. Swami Abhedananda had another well-known association, that of Swami Vivekananda, Sri Ramakrishna's direct successor. In 1896, Swami Vivekananda sent for Swami Abhedananda in New York and had him take over the running of the Vedanta Society, of which he was very successful and stayed on until 1921. Upon return to India, he founded his own Vedanta Society. Although many do not remember Swami Abhedananda, he led a profoundly holy life, surrounded by very holy men of great note. There are many fascinating works to his own name of great worth, and in 1939, he was the only living person and only disciple remaining, alive, who had met and known Sri Ramakrishna, a fact which 468 gave him unusual distinction in his later years. Perhaps a great introductory work to this great forgotten mystic is his work describing what is a yogi? How to be a yogi, by Swami Abhedananda, 1902, 4th edition, Vedanta Society, New York, USA, Notice of Attribution, scanned at sacredtexts.com, January, 2005. John Brunaher, redactor. This text is in the public domain in the United States because it was published prior to 1922. These files may be used for any non-commercial purpose, provided this notice of attribution is left intact. How to be a Yogi by Swami Abhedananda. Introductory. True religion is extremely practical. It is, indeed, based entirely upon practice, and not upon theory or speculation of any kind, for religion begins only where theory ends. Its object is to mold the character, unfold the divine nature of the soul, and make it possible to live on the spiritual plane, its ideal being the realization of absolute truth and the manifestation of divinity in the actions of the daily life. Spirituality does not depend upon the reading of scriptures, or upon learned interpretations of sacred books, or upon fine theological discussions, but upon the realization of unchangeable truth. In India, a man is called truly spiritual or religious not because he has written some book, not because he possesses the gift of oratory and can preach eloquent sermons, but because he expresses divine powers through his words and deeds. A thoroughly illiterate man can attain to the highest state of spiritual perfection without going to any school or university, and without reading any scripture, if he can conquer his animal nature by realizing his true self and its relation to the universal spirit, or, in other words, if he can attain to the knowledge of that truth which dwells within him, and which is the same as the infinite source of existence, intelligence, and bliss. He who has mastered all the scriptures, philosophies, and sciences, may be regarded by society as an intellectual giant, yet he cannot be equal to that unlettered man who, having realized the eternal truth, has become one with it, who sees God everywhere, and who lives on this earth as an embodiment of divinity. The writer had the good fortune to be acquainted with such a divine man in India. His name was Ramakrishna. He never went to any school, neither had he read any of the scriptures, philosophies, or scientific treatises of the world, yet he had reached perfection by realizing God through the practice of yoga. Hundreds of men and women came to see him and were spiritually awakened and uplifted by the divine powers which this illiterate man possessed. 2. Today he is revered and worshipped by thousands all over India as is Jesus the Christ in Christendom. He could expound with extraordinary clearness the subtlest problems of philosophy or of science, and answer the most intricate questions of clever theologians in such a masterly way as to dispel all doubts concerning the matter in hand. How could he do this without reading books? By his wonderful insight into the true nature of things, and by that yoga power which made him directly perceive things which cannot be revealed by the senses. His spiritual eyes were open, his sight could penetrate through the thick veil of ignorance that hangs before the vision of ordinary mortals, and which prevents them from knowing that which exists beyond the range of sense perception. These powers begin to manifest in the soul that is awakened to the ultimate reality of the universe. It is then that the sixth sense of direct perception of higher truths develops and frees it from dependence upon the sense powers. This sixth sense or spiritual eye is latent in each individual, but it opens in a few only among millions, and they are known as yogis. With the vast majority it is in a rudimentary state, covered by a thick veil. When, however, through the practice of yoga it unfolds in a man, he becomes conscious of the higher invisible realms and of everything that exists on the soul plane. Whatever he says harmonizes with the sayings and writings of all the great seers of truth of every age and clime. He does not study books. He has no need to do so, for he knows all that the human intellect can conceive. He can grasp the purport of a book without reading its text. He also understands how much the human mind can express through words, and he is familiar with that which is beyond thoughts and which consequently can never be expressed by words. Before arriving at such spiritual illumination, he goes through divers stages of mental and spiritual evolution, and in consequence knows all that can be experienced by a human intellect. He does not, however, care to remain confined within the limit of sense perception, and is not contented with the intellectual apprehension of relative reality, but his sole aim is to enter into the realm of the absolute, which is the beginning and end of phenomenal objects and of relative knowledge. Thus striving for the realization of the highest, he does not fail to collect all relative knowledge pertaining to the world of phenomena that comes in his way, as he marches on toward his destination, the unfoldment of his true self. Our true self is all, knowing by its nature. It is the source of infinite knowledge within us. Being bound by the limitations of time, space, and causation, we cannot express all the powers that we possess in reality. The higher we rise above these limiting conditions, the more we can manifest the divine qualities of omniscience and omnipotence. If, on the contrary, we keep our minds fixed upon phenomena and devote the whole of our energy to acquiring knowledge dependent entirely upon sense perceptions, shall we ever reach the end of phenomenal knowledge? Shall we ever be able to know the real nature of the things of this universe? No, because the senses cannot lead us beyond the superficial appearance of sense objects. In order to go deeper in the realm of the invisible, we invent instruments, and with their help we are able to penetrate a little further, but these instruments, again, have their limit. After using one kind of instrument, we become dissatisfied with the results and search for some other which may reveal more and more, and thus we struggle on, discovering at each step how poor and helpless are the sense powers in the path of the knowledge of the Absolute. At last we are driven to the conclusion that any instrument, no matter how fine, can never help us to realize that which is beyond the reach of a sense, perception, intellect, and thought. So, even if we could spend the whole of our time and energy in studying phenomena, we shall never arrive at any satisfactory result or be able to see things as they are in reality. The knowledge of today, gained by the help of certain instruments, will be the ignorance of tomorrow, if we get better instruments. The knowledge of last year is already the ignorance of the present year, the knowledge of this century will be ignorance in the light of the discoveries of a new century. The span of one human life is, therefore, too short to even attempt to acquire a correct knowledge of all things existing on the phenomenal plane. The life, time of hundreds of thousands of generations, nay, of all humanity, seems too short, when he consider the infinite variety to be found in the universe, and the countless number of objects that will have to be known before we can reach the end of knowledge. If a man could live a million years, keeping his senses in perfect order during that long period, and could spend every moment in studying nature and in diligently endeavoring to learn every minute detail of phenomenal objects, would his search after knowledge be fulfilled at the expiration of that time? Certainly not. He would want still more time, a finer power of perception, a keener intellect, a subtler understanding, and then he might say, as did Sir Isaac Newton after a life of tireless research, I have collected only pebbles on the shore of the ocean of knowledge. If a genius like Newton could not even reach the edge of the water of that ocean, how can we expect to cross the vast expanse from shore to shore in a few brief years? Thousands of generations have passed away, thousands will pass, yet must the knowledge regarding the phenomena of the universe remain imperfect. Veil after veil may be removed, but veil after veil will remain behind. This was understood by the yogis and seers of truth in India, who said, innumerable are the branches of knowledge, but short is our time and many are the obstacles in the way, therefore wise men should first struggle to know that which is highest. Here the question arises, which is the highest knowledge? This question is as old as history. It has puzzled the minds of the philosophers, scientists, and scholars of all ages and all countries. Some have found an answer to it, others have not. The same question was voiced in ancient times by Socrates, when he went to the Delphic Oracle and asked, of all knowledge which is the highest? To which came the answer, know thyself. We read in one of the Upanishads that a great thinker, after studying all the philosophies and sciences known at that time, came to a seer of truth and said, Sir, I am tired of this lower knowledge that can be gained from books or through the study of the world of phenomena. It no longer satisfies me, for science cannot reveal the ultimate truth. I wish to know that which is the highest. Is there anything by knowing which I can know the reality of the universe? The sage replied, Yes, there is, and that knowledge is the highest, by knowing which you can know the true nature of everything in the universe. And he continued, Know thyself. If thou canst learn the true nature of thine own self, thou wilt know the reality of the universe. In thy true self thou wilt find the eternal truth, the infinite source of all phenomena. By knowing this thou wilt know God and his whole creation. As by knowing the chemical properties of one drop of water, we know the properties of all water wherever it appears, so by knowing who and what we are in reality, we shall realize the final truth. Man is the epitome of the universe. That which exists in the macrocosm is to be found in the microcosm. Therefore the knowledge of one's true self is the highest of all that knowledge. Our real self is divine and one with God. This may seem to us at present a mere theory, but the nearer we approach the ultimate truth, the more clearly shall we understand that it is not a theory but a fact, that now we are dreaming in the sleep of ignorance and fancying ourselves this or that particular person. but as all experience gained in dreams afterwards appears of little consequence, so, waking up from this sleep, we shall find that the knowledge of phenomenal nature, upon which we place so much value at present, is of little importance. We shall then realize that all research in the various branches of science depends upon self-knowledge, and that self-knowledge is the foundation upon which the structure of phenomenal knowledge is built. Knowledge of the self or Atman is therefore the highest of all. It is the ideal of the science of yoga, and should be the aim of our life. We should hold it as our first duty to acquire this self-knowledge before we try to know anything concerning the objects of sense, perception. How can we gain it? Not from books, not through the study of external phenomena, but by studying our own nature, and by practicing the different branches of yoga. How to be a Yogi, by Swami Abhedananda, 1902. Almost last in the book is this to be extracted. Toward the morning of life. The Lord is present with every human being, urgent and instant to be received, and when a man receives him, as he does when he acknowledges him as his God, Creator, Redeemer and Savior, then is his first coming, which is called the dawn. From this time the man begins to be enlightened, as to understanding in things spiritual, and to advance into a more and more interior wisdom. As he receives this wisdom from the Lord, so he advances through morning into day, and this day lasts with him into old age, even to death, and after death he passes into heaven to the Lord himself, and there, though he died an old man, he is restored to the morning of his life, and to eternity he develops the beginnings of the wisdom that was implanted in the natural world. The people of heaven are continually advancing towards the spring, time of life, and the more thousands of years they live, the more delightful and happy is the spring to which they attain. Women who have died old and worn out with age, and have lived in faith in the Lord and in charity to the neighbor, come, with the succession of years, more and more into the flower of youth and early womanhood, and into a beauty exceeding every idea of beauty ever formed through the sight. In a word, to grow old in heaven is to grow young. Evil is hell. Evil with man is hell with him, for it is the same thing whether we say evil or hell. And as a man is the cause of his own evil, therefore he, and not the Lord, also leads himself into hell. So far is the Lord from leading man into hell, that he delivers him from it as far as a man does not will and love to be in his own evil, all a man's will and love remains with him after death. He who wills and loves evil in the world, wills and loves the same evil in the other life, and then he no longer suffers himself to be withdrawn from it. This is the reason that a man who is in evil is bound fast to hell and is actually there, too, in spirit. And after death he desires nothing more than to be where his evil is. After death, therefore, a man casts himself into hell, and not the Lord. Evil and punishment,